The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the December 2023 Walter magazine. We begin with the cover story, the Angus Barnes Christmas tradition. Each year, an all-volunteer crew decorates from top to bottom, by Hampton Williams Hoffer. When it comes to Christmas bedecking, there's the Biltmore Estate, there's Dollywood, and there's the Angus Barn. Even Scrooge would catch his breath in the iconic Raleigh Steakhouse's fantastical holiday display of thousands of lights, ornaments, legions of nutcrackers and reindeer. Angus Barn owner Van Uhr and her dedicated team of volunteer decorators unleash the ladders and LEDs in early October. Each year they reach new heights in bringing the Christmas cheer. Each room in the restaurant, from the wine cellar to the Wild Turkey Lounge, has its own decorative holiday theme, with the main dining room always adorned in traditional red and green, in a display that garners as much attention as the Angus Barn's award-winning food and wine selections. For many families, dining at the Angus Barn at Christmas is a tradition across generations, says Uhr. We want to make sure it's an unforgettable memory. She and her team erect scaffolding inside and aerial work platforms outside the restaurant, hanging lengths of garland, giant peppermint candies, stockings, wreaths, and ribbons galore. Decorations are kept as high as possible so as not to encroach on the prime table space, which accommodates some 800 diners at a time. It was 20 years ago, at her sister Shelley's urging, after a visit to the Greenbrier, that Uhr began decking the barn out for Christmas. In the early days, the staff assisted with decorating, arriving early in the mornings to hang candy canes and bells, and serving food as usual at night. Then about 8 years ago, one of Uhr's neighbors, Kate Park, stopped her in the street and said she wanted to help. Park had a crew of church friends whose children all attended preschool together, freeing up their mornings. She and her eight friends became the initial volunteers, donning pink T-shirts that read, "The Real Housewives of Angus Barn." Undaunted by the physicality of the work, the way it's tough on the hands and sometimes the heart, garlands fall, lifts threaten to tip, lights go out, the volunteers set to work hanging the tens of thousands of ornaments on the ceiling of the entrance. "We got it done," says Park, "and we never looked back." Now there's a sign up limiting eager volunteers to 20 per day. Park is at the barn from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., 5 days a week, starting in September. This year they're sporting Angus Barn Christmas Crew hoodies for what has become a cherished ritual, spending their fall mornings listening to classic rock while assembling a Christmas locomotive, setting up two new animated reindeer at the front door, and tucking in final touches like snowy owls and snowflakes into the garland. Park also makes around 50 trips per season to Michael's for the decorations, where she's been known to bring some cheese and crackers or pie to a patient checkout clerk. Uhr and her team are always adding more to every room, but the kitchen will be missing one important element this year. Chef Walter Royal, who passed away unexpectedly in May after 27 years as head chef at the Angus Barn. The jacket Royal wore when he won Food Network's Iron Chef America is now framed, hanging above the table that was, quote, his for years. Walter was a force, and losing him is a terrible blow, says Uhr. But the cooks are proud to be able to say that because of Walter, because of how well he trained them, the Angus Bar is going to be okay. New head chef Scott James, who worked with Royal for 9 years, this year saddles up for his first Christmas at the barn, serving up classics like the bone-in royal ribeye and barbecue pork ribs to families who've often waited all year to dine beneath shimmering garlands. The most popular holiday time slots at the Angus Barn fill up a year in advance. Some patrons book next year's table on their way out the door. In December, the kitchen churns out 2,000 gingerbread cookies a day, handed out by elves to patrons as they exit. Some rooms are snowy white and gold, glittering gold. Altogether, it's a wonderland of splendor. Many of the lights now stay up all year, only to be turned on at Christmas. But in the second week of January, all the other decorations, ornaments, ribbons, nutcrackers, wreaths, are carefully taken down by the same loyal team that put it all up. The decorations are tucked into labeled boxes and stored until the next fall, when Ewer will be back tying bows and traversing the scaffolding, leaning from the rafters to ask someone to toss her up another little artificial silver tree. Life is full of challenges, Ewer says, but at Christmas, when people walk through the doors of the barn, I only want them to feel magic. This article was edited for Time. From the Locals Department, Wild Rituals, Sri Lankapali keeps traditions from her homeland alive with Earth Folk Apothecary by Addie Ladner. A one-room wooden studio sits in the pine-filled backyard of Sri Lankapali's West Raleigh home. Here, floor-to-ceiling shelves hold vessels filled with dried rosebuds, hibiscus blossoms, wild turmeric, and burdock root. A copper distiller sits on a counter, and frankincense burns on an antique table. Light streams in from French doors, and a brass Tibetan bell hangs on the wall. In this space, Lankapali pays homage to her homeland in southern India and the generations that came before her. When she was a child in the hillside town of Chittoor, her mother would rub a chalky clay native to the area on her belly when she had a stomach ache. Her grandmother would give her a spoonful of honey with black pepper to ease a sore throat. I always felt better after these rituals. In India, we have a remedy for everything, she laughs. Among them, ginger for nausea, peppermint for bloating, cumin for constipation, and camphor for dry scalp. Such is the inspiration for Earth Folk Apothecary, a curated range of skincare products and teas that Lankapali makes by hand. My main focus is the very basics of skincare: cleansing, toning, moisturizing, and masking. In my opinion, that's all you need, Lankapali says. It's all rooted in Ayurvedic techniques, an ancient form of holistic medicine and living centered around mindfulness, nature, and viewing the body as an interconnected whole. The Cleansing Grains is a gentle dry powder cleanser made from chickpea and rice flour with rose petals, turmeric, and citrus. The Calming Potion is a tea of dried botanicals like lavender, St. John's wort, and passion flowers. The Keisha Hair Oil combines ingredients like neem, curry leaves, eucalyptus, camphor, rose, and lemongrass, all shipped to Lankapali from her family back home. She also enjoys scouring the local markets for ingredients native to North Carolina. I want to get more into biology and understand what's native. Not everything that comes from India is beneficial to people who were born and raised here, she says. You need something that's native to you. She sources beeswax from local apiary, Frushtinict honey, at the Durham Farmers Market, and calendula from Cedar Grove-based herb grower Maple Spring Gardens. She also uses cedar bark from her backyard, and sometimes from my neighbor who's kind enough to let me harvest from her gorgeous tree. Lankapali moved to the States in 2013 at 23 to get her master's in information systems at Eastern Michigan University. But she kept hold of her family's recipes for basic skin care. It was a part of our everyday life, a normal thing, she says. But out of a need to adjust to colder, drier temperatures, she had to go a little deeper. It was so cold, I needed something that would clean my face, but not strip the natural oils, she says. She tested a few different things, then started sharing them with friends and colleagues. I started selling them with encouragement from my friends. They loved my products and wanted to pay for them since they knew how expensive it was for my parents to ship me the ingredients, she says. As first-time customers became repeats, Lankapali started selling at markets and online, and Earthfolk was created in 2016. New customers are wonderful, but it feels special when someone comes back because the product works, she says. Lankapali and her husband moved to Raleigh in 2020, and she took a job at North Carolina State University as a business analyst. That year, they bought a house here and built the apothecary, which now drives a small but steady business. She opens her backyard studio twice a year, around the holidays and in the summer, and sells at markets in the Triangle. People can also order from her website and make an appointment to visit the shop. But Lankapali doesn't have any intention of it becoming a full-time job. Instead, it's a meditative, creative outlet for her. I love being able to use my hands and doing things like designing the labels, she says. It's a nice balance to my day job. And it's an education. In the evenings and on weekends, she's usually delving into a stack of books on herbalism, Ayurvedic medicine, or biology. One day, I'd love to learn how to make perfumes with hydrosols. I'm currently reading Kitchen Garden Revival to help me plan a backyard garden where I can grow most of my own herbs for the apothecary. But there's a fundamental reason for keeping these ancient skincare rituals alive. I cling to this because I'm away from home. As I grow older and farther from my family, memories become precious treasures. Those mundane days of my childhood have guided me toward a life I didn't realize I had fallen in love with. This article was edited for Time. Next, Earthen Vessels. From Seagrove to the World Beyond, Ben Owens III Shares His Pottery by Liza Roberts. The work of Ben Owen III is earthen and practical, but also brightly hued and sculptural. It fits in a hand for morning coffee, but it's also the lofty centerpiece of elegant spaces across the world. From the Sun Valley Resort in Idaho, to the Ritz-Carlton in Tokyo, to the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary, where his sculptural vessels fill spotlit niches and his handmade plates grace every table, Owen's art provides beauty and function. Pottery is one of the oldest inventions of humans, going back to pre-Neolithic times. Also unchanged, all hands on deck to get it done. It takes a team to keep a wood-fired kiln's flames stoked and blazing 24 hours a day for days on end. Like farmers raising a barn, potters fire a kiln together because they need each other. Owen was born to this life, born with Seagrove clay beneath his feet. His father and grandfather, Ben Owen Jr. and Ben Owen Sr., built the foundations for Seagrove's modern pottery community. Before them, as early as the late 1700s, their forefathers arrived from England, making and selling clay vessels to early settlers. Owen III works today on the same site his grandfather did. He was a great teacher and a great mentor for me, Owen says. showing me the fundamentals, building all those skills. Starting at the age of 9, Owen went out to his grandfather's studio every day to make pots. During these sessions, his grandfather taught Owen technique and aesthetics, as well as principles, how important it was to challenge oneself, to learn from mistakes, to greet change with enthusiasm, to eschew mediocrity, to, quote, never sell his seconds. I'm continually trying to find ways to refine the technique in my process, Owen says. How can I make the piece even better than I did last time? That commitment has taken his work not only all over the world, but has paved the way for its inclusion in museum collections, including the Smithsonian Museum of Art, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, the Gregg Museum of Art and Design, and in private collections. His work, in its various manifestations, has a timelessness about it, even when glazed in crystalline turquoise or lily pad green. I'm always experimenting, he says. A lot of people know us for our red glaze, but in recent years, I've been making glazes from nature, recreating things I've seen hiking with my son, looking at textures, lichen on a stone, moss on a tree. It's interesting to think, could I make a glaze that would create that effect? Some of Owen's pieces are finished in electric or gas-fired kilns, others in his wood-fired groundhog kiln. To witness Owen firing this kiln, a gourd-shaped 30-foot-long structure dug partway down into the earth, hence the name, is to witness a multi-day massive group effort, only accomplished a few times a year. Potters can't always predict what will emerge from the fire, what that day's particular combination of clay and heat, minerals and weather will produce. Colors or finishes on pots are almost like sunsets, Owen says. Each day it's a little different, and depending on what's present, just as the clouds or the temperature, the atmosphere, all affect the sunset, our glazes can react the same way. We learn to accept that. We try to control these things to the best of our ability, but we have to remind ourselves that our materials are constantly changing, and sometimes it can be a nice surprise. A few steps from this kiln, in the late 1990s, Owen built his own studio, right behind the one where his grandfather taught him. The newer spot is spacious, with separate workstations for different kinds of clay. There are pots in various stages of completion, one already 4 feet tall. When it's complete, this pot will be glazed an earthy blue, weigh about 250 pounds, and stand in the entry of a home in Greensboro. Owen pictures his blue vessel in place, mentions the conversations he's had with the collectors who've commissioned the piece. He welcomes the chance to work closely with the people who collect his work, some of whom were also collectors of his grandfather's work, and to get to know them, just as he does with visitors to his region and his studio. The role of ambassador is another he embraces. When you can find a way to develop a relationship with an individual customer or people coming out to visit the area, that gives us a springboard to tell people more about what the past has been and what we've been able to build on over the last several generations. I count my blessings that we've been able to support our family through the making of earthen vessels, he says. Really, the end product is how it's received by the people who use it. This article was edited for Time. Next, a deeper roast. Aralee Barrera Grodzki and Leon Grodzki Barrera brew conscious spaces for community, by Finn Cohen. Aralee Barrera Grodzki is standing in a glass-walled section of her coffee shop, Coco Cinnamon, where the roasting department of her coffee company, Little Waves, churns out 1,800 pounds of coffee a week. The shelves behind Grodzki are stuffed full of orders from their online business, with beans headed for customers in New York, Illinois, Kentucky, Michigan, and Washington State. This is the phase in which you start creating body and some of those sugar browning notes, Grodzki says, over the din of the roasting machine. She explains that these beans are in the phase known as first crack, when the hull of the bean splits as its chemical compounds start evolving. That's the pressure coming out, she says, pointing to the beans. So now go ahead and sniff it. It smells a little bit like vinegar. Vinegar is not a flavor anyone wants in their morning coffee. It's just a step on the way to the deeper qualities. Grodzki and her team are adept at pulling a plethora of notes from a wide variety of beans harvested from producers in Peru, Brazil, Rwanda, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Mexico, and Colombia. Their skills have not gone unnoticed. In 2022, Little Waves won Roast Magazine's Micro Roaster of the Year Award. And their three Cocoa Cinnamon locations in Durham are routinely packed with patrons working on laptops, reading, or deep in conversation. The current operation is a far cry from a decade ago, when Grodzki and her husband, Leon Grodzki Barrera, the two took each other's surnames, were pedaling a three-speed bike full of beans, grinders, and immersion brewers around downtown Durham. The couple moved to Durham from Cherokee, a small town on tribal land in western North Carolina, where Barrera ran a coffee shop slash art space called Kuala Java that was a central part of the community. Grodzki says, when you're creating a business that is so centered on community, you have to realize how you are as a person and how you show up, how you react differently, especially to really hard situations in a community, and how societal ills will show up at your front door. Durham made sense for creating such a space. In 2010, the city's downtown was just at the start of the transformation into the bustling hub of commerce that it is today. And the couple saw an opportunity to create the type of cafe in Durham that Kuala was for Cherokee. So they started running a business off of that converted bicycle, pedaling between farmers markets and events in Durham at places like Scrap Exchange and Motor Co. By 2013, the couple had established a name for themselves in Durham with a better understanding of the community and the market. A brick-and-mortar location made the most sense, and there was an ideal location on Gear Street, near Motor Co. and Full Steam Brewery. But they only had $75 and zero credit. The person who owned the building, Bob Chapman, had fielded business plans for more than a dozen people who wanted to open a coffee shop in the location. Chapman says Grodzki and Barrera had something no one else did. They knew a lot about coffee and had been putting that knowledge into practice with hard work. And they saw their mission, in part, as being part of a community. Chapman ended up co-signing a business loan for the couple to get started. The flagship Cocoa Cinnamon, across from Gear Street Garden, has cozy indoor seating and ample outdoor tables with lots of planters and string lights around the awnings. Once the business started doing well, they stumbled into a second location a bit further west, closer to the campus of Duke University. Around that same time, they found a third spot with enough room to build a roastery and start buying their own beans. Being mindful about the dynamics and history of coffee, was something Grodzki and Barrera wanted to do as they expanded the business, even if it meant paying a little more for beans. The approach of getting the cheapest price for maximum profit wasn't one they wanted to take. If you think about coffee's origins, they come from some of the poorer places in the world. There can be this imbalance, and our approach is more about how do we do this as a partnership, Barrera says. Similarly, part of the Little Waves ethos about community also means being deliberate about hiring and cultivating those employees with fair wages. Among their nearly 40 employees, the base hourly rate is $17.60, and they've had some employees rise through the company over the course of many years. Grodzki and Barrera also wanted to make sure the people working for them reflected the communities that make a city like Durham as multifaceted as it is. As the roasting side expanded, they're currently working on a larger facility to accommodate its growth. Little Waves has stuck to the principles they started with: open dialogue with the community, hard work, and efficiency. It's a delicate balance, but they see their success as a way to address the lingering effects of colonialism abroad and at home. It's just kind of bringing that history and that presence to the present day and shining a light on that representation that we want to keep seeing, says Grodzki. And our guests love the coffee, adds Barrera. This article was edited for Time. Lastly, a poem by Susan Willie Spate titled Reduced for Quick Sale. Like the draft of a sentimental poem, Christmas arrives every year with crazed couplets of family and home to fill us with something mistaken for cheer. We doggedly go from store to store, always afraid somehow we'll fail. The message of Christmas, buy more, family affection, reduced for quick sale. It's as if we're running for a train. We know we'll miss, but what if? What if we put an end to this holiday pain and stop searching for hope in expensive gifts? Could we find a holiday we've long neglected, and even the gift we least expected? We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.